Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wander Fox, and you are tuned in to 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And on today's show, I am going to play a conversation between Dr. David Kessler and Michael Pollan, as moderated by Michael Krasny of KQED. This is the 2010 annual luncheon, Food for the Soul, / Fuel for the Movement. And it is from the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. And there's not the greatest sound quality in the beginning, but it does get better. Again, it's David Kessler and Michael Pollan.
And we talked about this issue as well. Counting and taking notes as to whose hand went up when asked who listens to forum. But if you listen this morning, ironically, we were talking about obesity because we were talking about food addiction with respect to some new research that's been done at UCSF. And I wanted to begin the conversation. Well, first of all, I wanted to say what I said to Michael Pollan over lunch. As a kid of the 60s, we used to talk about the movement as being protest against Vietnam and protest in favor of civil rights. Now this has become the movement. It's synonymous. If you look in, maybe there's no Roger's thesaurus like this, but if you look in some thesaurus, it tells you what the movement, this would be there, and it's even referred to and alluded to quite frequently, I've noted, as a movement. In talking about obesity, we were talking about one of the hidden contributors, and I know, David Kessler, that you certainly have strong sentiments about this, that is food addiction and the whole question of food addiction. But rather than getting into what I was talking about just an hour or so ago, the way it was framed this morning was that there are lots of causes for obesity. And people look at genetics, the culture we live in, the fast food culture and all the rest of it. They look at the fact that there are too many to toxic diets to our young people. And there's too much extravagance, too, in excess. But I thought I'd begin by just talking to two who know this area so well and finding out from the journalist and the biologist what you think the pyramid is, as far as I know, pyramid usually refers to food, but in terms of what is most important in terms of the multifactorial nature of obesity. And when we look at this epidemic, what we need to look, almost in a triage sense, what we need to look at the top of it, and as we move down, can we best delineate that? Michael, can I begin with you?
That's a tough one. There are a great many factors, and I haven't ranked them in importance. One of the things that really struck me, I came at this looking at agriculture and found my way to thinking about obesity through what we had done to our agriculture, and which is to say, reorganize the food system, beginning really in the 70s around a cheap food policy, which seemed like a winner for everybody at the time, and you know, a deliberate effort to produce lots of cheap calories. It turned out we got very good at that, and we began overproducing, especially corn and soy, which happened to be very productive crops, very good ways to convert sunlight into carbohydrates, in the case of the corn and in the case of the soy, fat and protein. We got so good at producing so much of that that the price of the calories derived from those two crops, which is high fructose corn syrup and hydrogenated soy oil and feedlot meat, that we created an environment where the least healthy calories are the cheapest. It's an important lesson because I think it was a well-intentioned idea to make food cheaper, to make it more accessible, but it really backfired badly. And so I think at the bottom of this whole thing, I mean, you then get into human psychology and because the things you can make, I mean, as David has written about, you know, fat and sugar are very powerful drivers. And those are, of course, how we get fat and sugar off the land now. But I think that's where I see the driver and the change. And in fact, since that point, that change in policy, the obesity epidemic is normally dated to about 1980. We are eating somewhere between 400 and 500 more calories per person per day since 1980. Most of those additional calories are corn and soy calories transformed into snacks and soda. So that's what I would put at the base of that particular pyramid, corn and soy, in overproduction.
And really, the agricultural technology and the way things have moved forward so that stuff is so plentiful and so cheap.
The technology is a big part of it, but a lot of it is policy. The fact that we moved from a system of supporting prices to farmers, which we did with a series of various policy measures and having granaries, grain reserves, to a system of simply cutting farmers' checks for every bushel they could grow and with no checks on overproduction, which served the food industry, obviously, because they like these cheap calories. And this is the raw ingredients of the kind of manipulations that David wrote about so brilliantly in The End of Overeating.
Yeah, as Michael said, David, you certainly brought our attention in a very astute way to sugar and to fat. This morning, one of your former colleagues, Rob Lustig, was talking mainly about sugar and putting most of the emphasis on sugar. You agree with that? Or you have to see the two in pretty much in concert, as you, I think, are more apt to do.
So if I gave you a package of, I don't think there's any packets of sugar on the table, right? If I gave you a package of sugar right now and say, go have a good time, you would look at me and say, what are you talking about? Take that sugar, add fat, add texture, add mouthfeel, add temperature, add color, add the emotional gloss of advertising, put it on every corner, say you can do it with your friends, make it into entertainment, make our environment into a food carnival. What did we think was going to happen? So, but the answer to your question is, we do it in the audience.
I think you just gave it.
No. But the Manila milkshake, sugar, fat. We actually published a paper. Right? It's called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. Right? There's sugar in it, there's fat in it, there's flavor. If you look to see what the main driver is, how many of you think it's sugar? Raise your hands. In the audience, how many think it's sugar, the main driver? One person? Right? How many think it's the fat? Right? How many think it's the flavor? How many think it's all three? Sugar's the main driver. You'll work for sugar, right? You will work for sugar. Sugar is the motivating force.
These rats at UCSF were eating Oreo cookies, and they couldn't stop eating them. And then Fruit Loops. I mean, what's true in rats?
Tony Sclafani at Brooklyn College, Peter Rogers, University of Cambridge, back, you know, several decades ago, did very simple experiment. They gave rats normal rat chow. They looked at their weight. They added what they call the American supermarket diet, just put it in the cage, right? And the weight just grew exponentially. In the presence of a varied and limitless diet, animals and people tend to eat excessively.
Then we get into the troubling question, vexing question, which we did this morning about how much there needs to be controls for these drivers. How much does public policy have to be seen to intervene with what might be addiction, what might not be addiction, but what certainly drives people to be their own worst enemies and what creates this epidemic. In other words, when it comes to sin taxes, for example, on food, or when it comes to imposing rules that interfere with what libertarians would say is their right to drink as many Coca-Colas as they want or to fall victim to whatever advertising, if you see it as victimization, is out there. Where are the controls?
Public policy has already intervened. We just don't see it when it's been around for a while. It becomes the background. Public policy intervened when we decided we were going to, in effect, underwrite the cost of high fructose corn syrup with the way we subsidize agriculture. So it's a question of which public policy you want. There is no free market in the food system. There is no free market in agriculture. There has not been since at least the Depression. So fact, we kid ourselves that we're adding a layer.
There may not be a free market at all.
Well, there may not be. That's right.
But excuse me, Adam Smith said if there is, then if there's a hand that we call the free market, it's a palsy sure. hand. I just had to get in there because that was a brilliant remark that I just saw of Adam Smith's, but forgive me. But you're saying, in other words, those policies have already been...
It's a matter of choosing policies. Yeah. The interesting thing is that when you... I mean, you can... You know, it's very interesting that we're having a conversation about taxing sugar now, but we may find ourselves... Let's say we succeed with that, which would be, I think, on balance, a good thing. We will be stimulating the production on one end and then trying to squelch the consumption on the other. I mean, why don't we go back and deal with it in a systemic way?
David Kessler.
The average two-year-old compensates for their eating. What do I mean by that? If you give that child more calories at lunch, they'll eat fewer calories later in the day. By the time that two-year-old is 4 or 5, after being exposed to the American diet, that 4 or 5-year-old, on average, loses the ability to compensate. I mean, they're eating for reward, right? I mean, in the biological sense, it's as if they're eating throughout the day. They never experience any hunger. And those reward mechanisms of the brain take over and override the body's normal homeostatic mechanism. So this is happening now in between the ages of 2 and 5. If there were ever a case for, you know, the one thing government policy allows us to do, I mean, is to protect kids. You want to go as an adult, you want to go do something, go ahead and do it. But I will tell you, when I was trained, I know how to take care of a 60-year-old who gets type 2 diabetes. I understand the eye complications, the cardiovascular complications, the peripheral vascular complications. I know how to take care, and I know what that looks like to get that disease and live for 2 decades with that disease. I have no idea, none of us do as pediatricians, what it's going to be like to take care of that child for 6 or 7 decades and let those complications play out over an extended period of time. And that is very scary.
Do you set an age limit then in terms of watching out and being vigilant for the children the way you're suggesting? Where do we begin? Because certainly infants now are finding sugar in their in breast milk and formula and so forth. I mean, it's become a major problem even on the NATO level.
So I was on a panel with 4 diabetologists. And we went through the data, and it was pretty sobering. It was because, I mean, I think you can take steps. I think there are successes. I think you can take steps to protect people. And they just looked at me, and their conclusion was not an optimistic one. They basically said, when they looked at the data and the graphs and where this was headed, they said, we're toast as a country. I don't think that's the case. But the greatest gift I think you can give somebody is before the neural circuitry gets wired so that fat, sugar, and salt becomes, you know, a highly salient stimuli in someone's life. Right? Before that neural circuitry gets laid down, before that learning gets laid down, if you can prevent that from happening in the first place, because once that learning gets laid down, once that neural circuitry, right? I mean, I thought when I started looking at the question, right, you know, why is it so hard for so many people to resist? Right. I mean, I thought this was going to be the answer was going to be, sure, it's energy in and energy out and metabolism, you know, and how the body processes this. Right. What I didn't realize, you know, where I ended up, right, The way our brains work is that we're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli, the things that we've learned, the things we've experienced, the things in our environment, right? The things we become conditioned, the things that not only conditioned, but conditioned and driven to do that. Once that circuitry gets laid down, you know, it could, and it, again, you used the word addiction. I wrote a book, and I stayed away from using addiction. That word.
But when you describe it, it sounds very deterministic. It sounds like fate pulls over free will in ways that can't be curtailed.
But if a bear walked in here right now, right, I could assure you, even with my George Clooney here, you'd focus on that bear, right? We're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli, right? For some of us, it could be alcohol, it could be tobacco, it could be illegal drugs, it could be sex. I won't do, you know, Tiger Woods, he's highly controlled in this aspect of his life, right? But certain, each of us focus on different, that's part of being human, right? And we have, you know, for many people, what's the most socially acceptable salient stimuli in their lives? And that's what's happened. It's not a disease, but it's part of being human.
Then where does choice come in? Where does personal responsibility come in? Michael Collins, what do you think?
Well, it's a mix. I mean, you know, manipulation, it's an interesting vocabulary and it's an interesting framework. And people come to me and say, and I think because they've read your book, and they say that you know, are the food companies manipulating us? And I say yes, but so is your mother when she cooks you a really good meal. And so is Alice Waters when she cooks you a good meal.
Maybe
trying
my mother,
to make...
but not Alice.
And
I don't think David wants those two women confused.
you know, it is part of making food attractive. So I don't know how to draw that line. I don't know. Maybe you have ideas how to draw that line.
So first of all, I think something you have done, which has been very, very important, right, and I think transformational and key, is you focused on food. And I think it's very important to focus on food and not obesity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the real task and the real change over the next several decades that you've started is to get us to look at food differently. The problem, if you look at the problem with McDonald's, for example, it's not just what they serve. But when the McDonald's started opening up in Europe, if you look why the French have up until recently not been obese, the fact is there are social norms. Sure, they had highly palatable foods. Sure, the foods tasted good. But they also had certain social norms and certain social barriers. So you would never walk down the street eating. You would never eat between meals. You would never eat in a lecture hall. That was never acceptable.
Or in a car, yeah.
That was never acceptable. What did McDonald's do? McDonald's made it, you know, so that you can go in and you can carry out, you can eat something any time of day. Because all the restaurants and all the food establishments used to close, you know, a few hours after lunch and then close. We've made it so you can eat almost 24/7. It's acceptable to eat any time. So a lot of this has to do with our social norms.
Why are the French still so thin? I mean, when I was in Paris, Champs-Élysées, the McDonald's, they're all over the place. Are you big? They're thinner than we are. They're a hell of a lot thinner than we are.
There's a dirty little thing that I don't want to talk about.
Uh-oh.
Well, they smoke.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
So the reason, you know, at the end of the meal, they want to go and have a cigarette and have dessert. I mean, it's a question of alternate substitute. You pick your stimulus.
So are you saying you have something to do with this problem? Well, you got us off cigarettes.
David is also, of course, triumphant in the world of fighting tobacco, but not necessarily Gallic tobacco. Let me go right to the chase here. Congress, you've got their ear. What would be really your priority in terms of real legislation to change?
Oh, I don't think I have Congress's ear. We're talking about the culture. Congress is way behind the culture.
Granted. You've talked about ways that you thought could remediate this. If you had a possibility of framing a bill and saying this is going to get through Congress and you knew it had the stamp of Congress, not to say that Congress can be that effectual, but if you said we're sure that it was going to get through Congress, what would it be? How would you remediate?
Well, there's action that can be taken on many levels. There's the state things that is going on here. I think there's a lot the executive can do. And I'd love to get David's take on some of that, on things that the FDA could do if it were, if it felt empowered to do so. I think Congress will be the last to move. I think that the agricultural committees, until we start getting our urban legislators to feel like they will get a political reward for being on the ag committees, it is going to be beholden to production agriculture in the Middle West. And I think that's very important that we get health-minded Congress people. There are a couple now who are starting to ask to be on that committee. There's a woman I talked to from Western Pennsylvania who's a dietitian, and she decided when she's a freshman she wanted to be on the ag committee. And all the farm state guys, and they are guys, said, why are you on this? What do you grow in Erie County, Pennsylvania? And she said, we have eaters. And they were like, oh, we don't do that. We don't do eaters here. So I could sketch out what I think a farm bill should have, but I'm kind of, you know, I think the opportunity we have right now is in the executive, and I don't even knows what it can do. I mean, like a question I would ask David is, let's look at feedlot agriculture a little bit, which is part of the story too. Does the FDA have the authority to ban antibiotics, routine use of antibiotics in livestock, or not?
Yes.
Yeah. See, they're not sure they do, or they say they're not sure they do.
But they're moving on that. I mean, and for the first, I think it's very important. I mean, if you look at the, and I want to be careful here, I mean, on the references to tobacco, but if you look at public health successes, right? I mean, that is probably this country's, I would think, greatest public health success, right, over the last 30 years. And the question is, what was it? Right? It wasn't until this last June that the president signed the laws that gave FDA the ability to regulate tobacco. So it wasn't legislation, right? I mean, it wasn't lawsuits, right? It wasn't regulation. What was it, right? What we did is we changed how, I mean, those are important tools. We fought very hard for them. But we changed how we as a country view that product, right? We used to view that product as something 40, 50 years ago, our parents' generation, it was sexy. It was, those images were created. It was my friend. It was going to calm me down. We changed the valence of the product from positively valence to negatively valence. We demonized that product. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, you can't demonize food. And that's why it's much harder. We need food. Right? I mean, and it has to be enjoyable. And it goes to the emotional core.
Certain food has become demonized, though, I would argue. I mean, I think there's been a really successful campaign.
I think Michael has laid this out very well. I think that, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, in order to feed a hungry nation, to do it economically, the food industry learned how to process food. There were advantages of that. It was longer shelf life. It was economical. There were even food safety advantages, I mean, of doing that. What did they learn along the way? They learned to dial in fat, sugar, and salt, right? To the point where, you know, your seven words do capture, and you wrote about just imitation. FDA took away the imitation. Right? Most of our food should be labeled as imitation. Right? There are tools that can be used. I mean, you look in the health reform bills, right? Menu labeling at a national level, I mean, is in both of those bills. I went into one of the local, shows your effectiveness, Harold. I went into one of the local Chili's, and because I had written about it, and I saw what is it called, that awesome, that onion thing, awesome, and it wasn't on the menu. So I said, well, it's not on the menu anymore. And they said, you have to understand, California has this law that's going to take effect on menu labeling, and you know, corporate understood that that appetizer had 3,000 calories, and it didn't want to keep it on the menu and say it was 3,000 calories. So we reformulated the product and called it something else, and now it only has 2,000 calories. Right? So, I mean, you know, there's the government has a role, education and disclosure, right? But we have a role. We got to figure out how we change the social norms, because that changes our behavior and it changes the way our brains work.
How much did the labeling of cigarettes, though, really change behavior, change the culture? You know,
they're tools along the way. It was a chipping away, right? Nothing. I mean, it's the one reason. I mean, I think the First Lady has it right, and I think, you know, the organization that we're celebrating today here has it right. Any effort on these hard, challenging public health questions have to be comprehensive. There's not going to be any one tool.
Well, let me make a suggestion here, since I was thinking again about University of California and so much of the research that was done there. I think Stan Glantz played a big role in changing the whole nature of how we regard, because of secondhand smoke. This is one of the leading researchers of secondhand smoke. If we could get that kind of maybe shame or disgust with certain kinds of food, and I think it's happening. I think it's in the bloodstream culturally.
But you have something else that's working for us, and it's very different. Right? Food has a powerful emotional appeal. It's as direct. It's why it's so hard, you know, to stop. It's why it's so hard, you know. It's why sugar and fat, I mean, it's so powerful, because it's directly wired from the orosensory to you know the primitive aspects of our brain. It is it's the emotional core of our brain. And I think that increasingly, when people care about it, I mean, it really, when you realize the power of food and the importance of food, and if we can, and that's why I think what you have done, Michael, I mean, in the focus on real food, cigarettes always, that emotional appeal was falsely generated. It was generated by PR firms. The march, what was in the 1920s, the debutantes walked down. It was they hired psychiatrists to figure out, you know, the tortures of liberty, to equate cigarettes with freedom and coolness, and that was all manipulated. Mm-hmm. Food is at our emotional core. So moving back to real food,
we've seen those advertisements, but I'm just wondering how much psychologically does comfort food provide for a kind of escape from things like anxiety and depression, the way one could argue tobacco did for many people. People would smoke because they were nervous. They would smoke because they said it made them feel some kind of relief psychologically or emotionally.
So you know, watch people eat. And not everybody. I mean, this doesn't affect everybody. But you watch people. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, excessive eating takes place between about 4 and bedtime, right? And, you know, I've always wanted to understand that. And if I'm, you know, and you see people sometimes at 10 o'clock at night, a long day, very stressed, right? They'll go in the kitchen, and they won't talk about it. I mean, it's done somewhat secretly, and what is it? What's going on? When you understand that, you know, if I can focus on the food captures me. I'm in those moments of enjoyment and pleasure and relaxation. I'm almost in a trance-like state, and I'm not thinking about anything else. And it's why it calms me down. It really is plugged in to it's the emotional core.
I'm going to go away from Congress and ask you the same question, Michael, if I may. If you had the executives.
Sorry to cut that off. We're at the end of the show for today. I'll have to play the second half next week. You are listening to Your Homegrown Food here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. And I'm your host, Wander Fox. Thanks for tuning in this week. This is a show about all things food. Hope you enjoyed that little clip of Michael Pollan and David Kessler, and moderated by Michael Krasny from KQED. And if you'd like to hear the entire conversation, I have a link to it on my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. You can check that out and find a link. Or you can go to publichealthadvocacy.org, and that's where you can listen to the entire conversation. Or you can tune in next week at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesday and hear the second half of that conversation. So I will speak with you all again next week. You can tune in to Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday from 11:30 to 12. And I bid you a wonderful afternoon, and I'll speak with you next week.
This is Teabag.